You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Akash Kapoor moved back to India in 2003 after spending a decade in the United States, he was enthusiastic about the changes the tech boom had brought to his native country. Many of his neighbors had been lifted out of desperate poverty by the new prosperity, and opportunities had opened for women and for Dalits, the caste formerly known as the Untouchables, that had not existed just 10 years earlier. But not long after he'd settled with his young family near the village in which he'd grown up, he began to notice that India's new prosperity had a dark side. Violence was on the rise. The long-standing social order had begun to crumble, and the millions of people who hadn't been helped by the economic boom were as poor and as hungry as ever. Akash Kapoor has recorded his observations in a new book called India Becoming. It's just out from Riverhead, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Isn't your book's title a twist on something Albert Einstein once said when he was talking about this country?
Yeah, it is. It comes from a letter that Einstein actually wrote about America in the late 40s when he said that America was a country never being, always becoming. And when I moved back to India from the United States in late 2003, it seemed to just sort of so perfectly capture that energy and that sense of forward momentum and optimism in India that I had always seen in America.
And you wrote an opinion piece that was published in last Sunday's New York Times under the headline "How India Became America." So, are you saying in this book that India is becoming more like America, or is the situation a bit more complicated?
Well, yeah, I think there's a subtle but important difference between the headline, which said "How India Became America," and the article, which talked about the process of Americanization underway in India. And obviously, you know, India hasn't become America and won't become America. I'm not sure what that would mean.
Well, at this point, many Indian businesses operate on American time and even honor American holidays: Thanksgiving, Martin Luther King Day. Why is that? Because they have to close down because American businesses are closing down?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, these are the outsourcing businesses, which is sort of like the new economy businesses in India. And yeah, they operate on American time because, for example, they're handling credit card queries or whatever. So not only, yes, you know, it is striking when you talk to Indians and they say, "Oh, I had the day off because it was Martin Luther King Day," but also they work on night shifts a lot of the time for the same reason.
Now, a lot of the entrepreneurs have been educated in this country and worked in this country before they went back. That's got to be a change as well, because for many years Indians went to England, didn't they, as part of the Commonwealth?
Yeah, I think, and that's one of the fact that so many of the entrepreneurs, and for that matter, you know, professors and scientists and just a lot of Indians have spent time in the U.S. and been educated in the U.S. is at the core of this process of Americanization, which is one aspect of a broader transition and transformation in India. And you're absolutely right that represents a change from what used to happen, which was more of a sort of looking towards England.
Well, do people come here to be educated knowing they're going to go back, or...?
I think that varies. I mean, I don't think that there's any sort of formula there or whatever. But I think that what happens now and what's changed over the last 15 years is that once they get out of school here, once they get out of college here, they see that there's all these amazing opportunities in India that there didn't used to be. And so, like, for many people, the prospects of starting a new business just seems so much more promising in India than in the U.S. right
now.
How
did your father come here?
My father, you know, he came here because he wanted to get educated, and he came here in the 60s. It was pretty unusual for his generation to go back. I mean, he often says that, you know, people thought that he was crazy for moving back because at that time it didn't feel like there were a lot of opportunities in India.
But he went back with an American wife.
He went back with an American wife, yeah.
Which was even crazier. Was that considered odd?
Yeah, which was even crazier. People wondered why she was moving back, and, you know, they wondered why they were both moving back. They were more inspired by kind of late 60s hippie idealism, in a sense that the world was being remade and that, you know, it was going to be remade in a way that was coming out of India.
So they joined a commune.
Yeah, they moved back inspired by the sort of communitarian ideas.
And does that commune still exist?
Yeah, the commune still exists. In fact, I live there and my parents live there too.
But how did you wind up spending so much time in this country?
Well, it happened in sort of two phases. I mean, partly when I was a young child, I spent time in the U.S. because I would come and visit my grandparents, and you know, my mother still maintained her ties with her family in the U.S. And then when I was 16 or 17, I came to boarding school in America, and then stayed on for college and a little bit after college. So I spent about 10 years in this country before moving back.
Well, you had grandparents in Minnesota.
Grandparents and 9 aunts and uncles.
Your childhood must have been somewhat different from that of the typical Indian child because of all of these different things. Was it also different because you were raised in that commune?
Yeah, on both counts, I would say it was quite different, yeah.
You've said that your father was one of the earliest generations of Indians to be educated in the United States. Now, why, whether it's Britain or the United States, aren't there good schools in India?
Yeah, there are good schools in India, particularly sort of technology schools. I mean, the IITs, the Indian Institutes of Technology, are probably some of the best in the world. I think, for example, if you want, you know, a liberal arts education, you're still better off coming to the U.S. And for many years, people were attracted to the U.S. not just for the education. I mean, education was a stepping stone to the broader opportunities, the economic opportunities, the jobs, the entrepreneurial opportunities that the U.S. offered that the India didn't offer. As I said, that's changed, and more people now come to the U.S. and see that there are these opportunities back in India. I also met many people, and I interview them in the book, and I talk about them, who just decide they want to stay in India. You know, this one guy I interviewed in the book who's sort of like a new generation Indian, and he tells me, I got all these job offers in Europe, I got all these job offers in America, I have an Indian MBA. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I would have jumped at him. Now I say, why? The future is here. I'm going to stay here.
Well, did you assume that you would be staying in this country? You stayed here for 10 years.
I was undecided. I wasn't really sure. I certainly, you know, most of the time I was here, I never was sure that I would move back to India. That sort of started building in the early 2000s as I started realizing. For me, it was less about the entrepreneurial opportunities per se, as much as there was this amazing sense of ferment and change and energy. And I just found it so culturally and intellectually exciting to be in a country that where so much was happening.
Well, you're married. You have 2 kids.
Mm-hmm.
Do you plan to send them to the United States for schooling when they get older?
I haven't decided that yet. We'll have to see what happens. We'll have to see where the country is. They're young, and things are changing so fast in India right now that, you know, who knows where India is going to be and what it's going to have become 10 years from now, really.
My guest is Akash Kapoor, who's the former Letter from India columnist for the International Herald Tribune, also the online editor of the New York Times. He's written a book called India Becoming, A Portrait of Life in Modern India. So when you returned in 2003, you were struck by a tremendous sense of optimism and energy. Do you still feel that sense of optimism, or has it begun to wear off?
I think that the optimism is still there in the country. I think the country still has, certainly if you compare it to where it was 20 years ago, it's still very optimistic. I think that there's a greater sense of realism creeping into the country now. Certainly in my personal case, that optimism has been tempered a little bit, which is not to say that I feel pessimistic about India's future or that I think, you know, India's heading to a bad place necessarily. I just think that when India liberalized its economy in the early 90s, there was this sense of immediate emancipation and freedom and this unleashing of all these forces that had been held down and repressed for so long. And I think now the country's sort of looking at it more squarely and realizing that, well, it's more complex than we thought it was initially.
Because moving forward also means sacrificing certain things.
Yeah, you become more aware of the loss that accompanies the gain, of the new forms of poverty that accompany the prosperity.
And then the people who are left behind.
The people who are left behind. And, you know, and development and progress are not simple forces. They're powerful, wrenching, double-edged forces. And I say somewhere in the book, I say, you know, for everybody whose life was rejuvenated, I felt like somebody whose life was being destroyed, basically.
Were you disturbed from the start by what seems to be a widespread fixation on money and brand name consumer goods, especially among young people?
I would say that I'm disturbed now. When I first moved back to India, and part of what I try to convey in the book, because I don't want to be, you know, moralistic and judgmental about it, I was excited by it too because it felt so different. It felt part of the kind of emancipation of India. We felt like, wow, you can go out and you can buy things and there's new brands out on the street and it all felt new and fresh. The question is, you know, is the new sort of capitalist India going to be balanced with other forces?
Well, we're seeing something similar, of course, in China. And in both cases, we come from, China, communist, India, socialist, How was it taking the lid off and allowing capitalism something that suddenly changed people's attitudes about all sorts of other things? For example, one of the people you talked to felt that now it's India is more concerned with what you do than who you are.
Yeah, I think, and I think that's a very important part of the transition. And it's important to realize that, you know, making a country more capitalist doesn't just mean that people care about money and buy things. It also introduces these other things, which are arguably more positive, which is a greater sense of meritocracy, a greater sense of individualism and individual emancipation. People are less tied down by ancient bonds and of caste, for example, or tradition than they used to be. And these are all wonderful aspects of India's transition to a capitalist economy.
But there's also more violence of a there's been violence all along, but violence of a different sort today.
Yeah, I think it's a different kind of violence because obviously with that sort of individual emancipation and with the fraying of ancient bonds, social bonds that held society in place, often that were repressive. But when those bonds fray, of course, new forces are unleashed. And so you do get new forms of violence and social sort of disruption.
Where does Hindu nationalism fit into all of this? Because there's been a growth of that.
There has been. I think that I actually think that Hindu nationalism was a big story in the 90s in India. And I think that over the last 10 years, India has been on this kind of this growth path. And it's been very focused on sort of, you know, getting ahead in the world as an economic superpower, as it often calls itself. And I think that, in my opinion, that sort of made Hindu nationalism less of a political force, per se, than it used to be.
It's been pointed out that China's rise is based on manufacturing, while India's rise is based largely on high tech. Also, the service industry. So did that just happen naturally, that dividing up of the new things that were required in the 21st century?
I think that it probably arose as it was playing to India's inherent strengths, which were that it had this relatively creamy layer of highly educated people that had been to these IITs that we were talking about before, the technical institutes, and this was just sort of India's core strength.
And a lot of people speak English.
And a lot of people speak English, obviously. That was another major factor.
You use the stories of individual people to help illustrate India's economic transformation, including those of a local village elder, a young woman who left her village to work in a call center in the city, and a successful young business executive who was a closeted homosexual. How did you choose the people you were going to write about?
It was mostly serendipity. I mean, I tried not to sort of, you know, come up with a quota where I needed to have one of these and one of that. And there were moments when I worried that, made, you know, I wanted to make sure it was all working out. But it was pretty serendipitous. I would meet people through other people. In the rural chapters in particular, because a lot of the book is set in rural India, it was very important to sort of meet one core person that would open up the world to you.
And it was important for you to set this in rural India because so much of the reporting we get is from the big cities.
Yeah, that was very important to me, partly because that was the place where I had grown up, and so it was the world I knew, but also because, you know, as you say, so much of the reporting you read is from the cities, but 70% of India still lives in the countryside.
Have we been being given a distorted picture?
I think to some extent. I mean, there are reporters and writers that write from rural India. I would never claim to be the only one, but I think it's absolutely important to recognize that when you're reading a report or a book or whatever from the cities, you're only getting a very, very small fraction of India there.
The population of India's cities are expected to grow by 300 million people over the next 20 years. That's equal to the entire population of the United States.
Yeah. I mean, there is a process of urbanization underway. I say somewhere in the book that the center of gravity was shifting towards the cities. And, you know, Gandhi called the villages the soul of India. I think in many ways that soul is shifting to the cities. But as I said, 70% of the country still lives in the countryside.
My guest is Akash Kapoor, K-A-P-U-R. His book, India Becoming, A Portrait of Life in Modern India. It's published by Riverhead Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Akash Kapoor. His book, India Becoming, A Portrait of Life in Modern India, published by Riverhead Books. You seem to develop an especially close relationship with the village elder, a landowner named Sathi, who had lost much of his power during India's economic transformation. He had mixed feelings about what's going on in India.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what drew me to him and made him so interesting that in that sense I found him quite wise, actually, that he was able to remove himself from his immediate circumstances and his personal circumstances and look at the bigger picture. So we would have these conversations where his sense, you know, he was very conflicted, and I found that really fascinating, where he'd say things like, you know, I know this is good for the country, I'm glad it's happening for the country, I'm glad it's happening for my people, but for me, you know, it's been rough, and for my family, it's been a tough transition.
Well, he's concerned that farmland is being neglected, but also that old values are changing.
Yeah, and that the village world he knew is changing. There's a lack of respect. Agriculture is dying, as you say. All these, that basically this world that had, you know, essentially in some respect remained unchanged for centuries was now undergoing not only a process of change, but this amazingly compressed, rapid change.
But why are the farms being neglected? India still has to feed itself.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about the seamier side or the darker side of India's transition and development, I think that the decline and, you know, death of agriculture is one of the sort of the seamiest aspects of it. And it's a combination of forces that's making it happen. Part of it is very strongly linked to the new economy and the emancipation. You know, young people that grew up in the villages that would have once taken over their parents' farms, now they move to the cities. They get jobs in the IT companies. They don't want to work in farming. Part of it is also environmental. The land's drying up. The water tables are declining, and then again, you know, the new what's happening with this new money that's being generated in urban centers. A lot of it is trickling out to the countryside, and so farmers sell their land and turn it into real estate because they make a lot more money that way.
Well, the farmers who can't find help in this country often go to undocumented immigrants. Is there some kind of a labor pool like that in India?
I don't think, I mean, I can't really think off the top of my head of a sort of a similar labor pool in India, but labor is a major issue. That is another reason why farming is dying, and any large farmer you talk to will complain, saying, you know, we can't find the labor anymore, we can't find the labor. And if you think about it, that sort of embodies, you know, the ambivalence of this transition, because on the one hand, the reason they can't find the labor is a wonderful thing. It's because these people that would have once worked for very cheap or essentially free for these farmers now have other options, so they don't need to work in farming anymore. But at a macro level, what does that mean? It means that farming's dying. It means that, yes, as you said, the food supply is going down, and it has all kinds of social and environmental consequences for the country.
And what about the government? Are they expressing any concern about this?
Yes, the government is concerned about it. India is a democracy, and so that means that when these things start happening, there have been, you know, riots. There have been sort of expressions of political anger over rising food prices, food inflation, and things like that. It's a very complex problem, and even if the government's sort of institutional capacity was stronger, and it isn't that strong, particularly in rural areas, it isn't entirely apparent how you would address something like this.
Well, despite the boom, you cite a statistic showing that more people went hungry in India during the most recent decade, between 2000 and 2010, than during the 1990s. So is there kind of are we seeing a growing gap between rich and poor or middle class? Well, we have a growing middle class. Are the poor being left behind?
I think that there are new forms of inequality coming up in the country for sure, and I think it's very important to recognize that many Indians are being left behind by the boom. I mean, 300 million Indians live on less than a dollar a day still. That's a large number of people.
Well, it's again the population of the United States, pretty much.
Right.
You also write about Sathi's wife, an independent, educated woman from Bangalore named Banu. She seems to have one foot in the old India and the other in the new India, and appears to be struggling to balance her career and her family the way that some American women had to deal with in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I think Banu led a very complicated life, because for one thing, she grew up in the cities, and she married this man who was very, you know, married to his farms and married to his ancestral land.
But he was also a wealthy landowner.
He was a wealthy landowner, but part of the story there is that his wealth has declined, certainly relative to the people around him, but also as farming has become tougher, the asset value of their land is still high, but just income isn't what it used to be, right? But the other point about Banu, as you said, is that, yes, she struggled with these issues that women in the West have been struggling with now for, you know, decades, but are relatively new in India.
Well, they end up remaining married but living apart. Is that working well for them?
Yeah, well, at the very end of the book, they actually come back together. They spend much of the book and much of the time I knew them. She lived in Bangalore with the kids, and he would commute to the cities, which was, you know, tough for both of them. It was very interesting for me as a writer because he would go to the city to see his kids, and he would come back and he would talk about what he'd seen in the city and how he felt about what he'd seen in the city. And it was clear that in many ways, the new wealth in the cities and the new sense of meritocracy in the cities was somewhat threatening to him.
It's interesting that during the socialist period, the caste system still remained fairly entrenched. And it's only now that that's breaking down. You also write about a Das who was a member of the Dalit class, which used to be called the Untouchables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, first of all, I think, you know, the caste system is still quite strong, unfortunately. But it is weakening. It's a very, very old system, and it's deeply, deeply embedded in Indian culture and society. And you know, even during the socialist or semi-socialist period in India's history, the government tried, it's enshrined in the Constitution of India, that they try to sort of weaken the bonds of caste. But they're persistent and they're strong.
But now someone like Das says he felt his life had been a miracle. Instead of being forced to clean toilets, he was able to go to college, get a job, build a two-story house with TVs and air conditioning,
right,
and even pay for medical care for his family,
yeah,
something that would have been totally beyond him 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, and that if what we were talking about earlier embodied the sort of seamier side of development, that embodies, you know, the wonderful emancipatory aspect of India's development. And one of the things that's most amazing about Das is if you go visit this new house that you're talking about, this new two-story house with the air conditioners, right in front of it is the hut where he grew up. This tiny hut, you know, like 3 by 4 meters, thatch hut, no electricity. 12 people lived in that hut. And this is real, you know. I mean,
keeping it as a reminder?
No, he uses it as a storeroom now. You know, he's not sentimental or nostalgic about it. He uses it as a storeroom. But you go there and it's this amazing contrast. And then towards the end of the book, he bought this new air-conditioned SUV vehicle that he'd parked between the house and the hut.
But you're saying we shouldn't read too much into that. Not all of the Dalits are benefiting from the changes.
Not all. I mean, it's like most things in India. It's complex and layered, and it is happening. It's very real. Das is not the only Dalit in India that's come up in the world. It's definitely happening.
My guest is Akash Kapoor. His book, India Becoming, A Portrait of Life in Modern India, published by Riverhead Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You'd been writing for the International Herald Tribune and for the New York Times. Did this book take you away from those jobs?
The book started before I started my column at the International Herald Tribune. I mean, I've been writing freelance for a long time, so I think the column sort of happened alongside it. It didn't take me away from it, per se.
Well, some of our listeners will be familiar with parts of this book because there was an excerpt published in the October 10th issue of The New Yorker, which focused on Ramadas, a man who works as a broker in a cattle market in the village of Brahmadesan. I was surprised to learn that cattle markets even exist in India because I've always assumed that Hindus hold cows sacred. You can't sell them.
Well, the important thing to realize is that traditionally and historically, these cows were not necessarily being sent to slaughterhouses, that these were primarily agricultural markets. So it was part of the farming economy. Part of the reason these cattle markets are so interesting is they offer a window onto the changing rural economy. And as farming has declined and as India has modernized, increasingly these cows are not being bought by farmers for work in the fields, but they're being bought by businessmen who send them off to slaughterhouses to be killed.
And are people starting to eat beef?
Yeah, more and more. I mean,
because in the past it was the Muslims who ate beef.
Yeah, it's still, I mean, I would say that, you know, I would probably, a majority of Indians would probably still wouldn't eat beef and would still sort of look down on it. But the numbers have risen for sure.
And Ramadas tells you he's not bothered by selling cattle because he's an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't atheism rather unusual in India?
He's an unusual person. He's a funny, unusual person. He comes out of a tradition of atheism that was particularly strong in the state of Tamil Nadu, where I did a lot of this research. It grew. It was a rationalist atheist movement that was a form of Dalit or untouchability, a form of emancipation for the Dalits.
Reject traditional Hinduism.
Right, to reject these sort of religious.
But they could have become Buddhists, couldn't they?
Well, they became atheists. They became rationalists, and his Ramadas' sort of rhetoric really embodied that rationalist rhetoric. He would say things to me, you know, like, I believe in injections. I believe in doctors and science, you know, and he had all kinds of funny stories along those lines.
So he's another Dalit who has done well for himself. You followed the stories of a couple of young people who'd moved from rural villages to cities to work in India's exploding tech industry. Although they were both successful, neither Selvi, a 21-year-old single woman who worked in a call center, or Hari, a wildly successful employee of a multinational outsourcing company, seemed unable to ultimately free themselves from the expectations of their traditional families.
Yeah, I think it was very interesting in both their cases. They moved to the city. They experienced a lot of sort of emancipation and freedom in a way that their parents would never have experienced. But yes, the bonds of family and the bonds of tradition are strong and kept sort of gnawing at them and pulling them back.
Are arranged marriages still the norm?
I don't know if they're the norm per se, but they're very, very common. And in both cases, in Selvi's case, she moved back and had an arranged marriage. In Hari's case, it was more complicated because he's gay, and every time he went home, his parents would insist he had to have an arranged marriage, but he couldn't come out to them and he couldn't tell them he was gay, so he kept resisting it, and it led to a lot of anxiety and tension.
So I should assume that a lot of gays and lesbians wind up getting married. And then that's really unfair to the spouse, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that has sort of historically been the norm. And I talked to a sex therapist in the book, or sexologist, as he calls himself. And he talked about the fact that, you know, one of the positive changes he's seen in his practice is that gay people are more and more willing to come out and acknowledge the fact that they're homosexual before marriage, because he said he used to see all these cases of people coming to him after marriage saying, doctor, like, figure out a way, you know, for me to get her pregnant, because if I don't get her pregnant, this is going to get really bad. And he said, you know, in the days before Viagra, he never knew what to do. Now at least he could give them Viagra and get them pregnant.
Selvi told you that when she moved to the city, she was determined not to get into trouble by drinking or dating. But her reputation was damaged anyway, even though she lived up to her promises.
Yeah, her reputation is important to emphasize that she didn't date and she didn't drink and she didn't do anything quote-unquote bad. But, you know, her reputation was damaged because one of her roommates got involved in a very tragic love affair. And such is the hold of tradition and sort of norms about how women should behave, that roommate's tragic affair ended up tainting all the other women by association, partly because they all worked together in a call center. And so, you know, the story became that this is what happens to new women when they work in call centers. They get corrupted.
Same sort of thing is happening in China, where people are moving to the big cities on the Pacific coast, moving from the farm inland, and becoming estranged from their families, becoming more modernized, and when they go back, their families don't recognize them.
Yeah.
And feel that they've lost control over them.
Yeah, and I think here, in the case of these two characters, there was a sort of divergence that the family was ultimately able to control Selvi, but not Hari. And there may be something to the fact that may be partly attributable to the fact that she was a woman and he was a man also.
Would Hari have had too difficult a time as a gay man in a small town?
Yeah, I think it would have been, I mean, as it was, he was having a hard time in a big city. I think that in a small town, you know, he would have never been able to come out or anything, but he might not even have fully even recognized or been able to articulate his own homosexuality, because that even as a concept or an idea was so new to him when I first met him.
But there are no laws against homosexuality.
Well, actually, until this is an ongoing issue in India, that there is an old a colonial law that has been interpreted to be to criminalize homosexual behavior, and this law was overturned by the Delhi High Court last year or a couple years ago, and is now on appeal to the Supreme Court of India, because sort of conservative groups in India are appealing the High Court's decision. So it's a little bit in limbo. The law, it should be said that the law was very, very rarely applied, even when it was on the books.
Even though Hari is well paid, doesn't he end up spending more money than he earns in shopping malls?
Yeah.
He seems to love to shop. He owns 20 different watches, one for every mood. He has 20 different moods.
Hari was something of a fashionista. Yeah, I think he, to some extent, Hari, you know, he's a great guy, but he emblematizes that new consumerist India to some extent. I mean, he had, you know, credit cards being thrown at him. He ran up a lot of credit card debt, because most of these purchases that you're talking about were done on credit cards. And one of my you know, favorite scenes in the book is actually the shopping scene when I go shopping with Hari, and he's just like he's a whirlwind through the shopping mall, you know, stopping in at every store, buying bags full of stuff, walking out to the next store, flashing his frequent buyer cards at stores. So, and that, you know, has to be said, that is very new. When I was growing up, we didn't have that.
So are people going to the same kind of debt that we've experienced in this country over the past few decades?
I think there's a problem with debt. I mean, you know, credit card penetration rates and so on are still much lower than in the U.S., so not to the extent maybe as in the U.S. But yes, the new generation has issues with debt.
I'm sure many people are watching all of this and saying all of our social norms, all our traditions are being destroyed, and this is all bad for India.
Yeah. You have that sort of conservative reaction to what's happening, and you know, part of what I try to do in the book is try to take a little bit of a middle road here, because obviously part of me feels nostalgic for the way things were, and part of me has these inherent reactions too. But you have to recognize that, as I was saying earlier, it's a double-edged process, and you know, Hari's emancipation and his ability to articulate his homosexuality comes with debt in a way. There's a price to be paid with progress, and I was trying to write both about that price and the progress.
So does it depend what city you have moved to, whether you've gone to Delhi or Calcutta or whether you've gone to Mumbai?
Partly you end up in these cities based on where you grew up, which is to say, if you grew up in the south, you might be more likely to end up in Chennai than Delhi. I think all the big cities are more or less on this sort of this booming path. And I think increasingly a lot of the smaller towns, that this is trickling down to the smaller towns too.
Akash Kapoor's book is India Becoming, A Portrait of Life in Modern India. It's published by Riverhead Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. That was great.